minds should instantly go to Proverbs 31 and the description of, right, what a noble woman looks like, or what a wife that is worthy of pursuit should look like. The interesting thing, Tim, that you and I would know is when we look at the order of the English Bible, right? Ruth, Proverbs, they're not next to each other. And so you go, okay, that's maybe an interesting connection based on terminology or ideas, but it's much more explicit actually in the Hebrew text. A common ordering of the books in the Tanakh, which is the name for the Hebrew Bible, is that Proverbs precedes Ruth. Ruth is not actually in its current location where next to, you know, Judges and Samuel, but it's put with the Ketuvim, the writings. And so Proverbs 31 is quite literally the preceding chapters before Ruth. And that's not accidental, right? That seems to be, hey, we have a proverb of what is a wonderful woman, right? What does a noble woman look like? You go straight into the story of Ruth. And I think that arrangement is supposed to show, because here's how it looks like in the flesh. Here is a story of someone living out these ideals and what it looks like. Tim, at least my mind goes to in Proverbs 31, right? The idea of the reputation in the village and the reputation in the gateway to the village. That's a scene that's about to come up in this book in the next chapter. And I don't think that's accidental. We're seeing the proverb played out in the real life of Esther. At least that's the connection I see. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And it makes me think, Brian, as we consider the plight of Ruth, Ruth comes to Bethlehem. Her reputation is unknown, but it's almost as though Boaz realizes it had to have happened this way. Like, let's just run a scenario where maybe the kinsman redeemer sees Ruth and Naomi and says, okay, well, I'll redeem them. Or maybe Boaz does from the beginning. Well, that stigma is still going to be attached. Unless there is a demonstration of Ruth's faithfulness in the midst of adversity, people aren't going to be able to see what kind of woman she is. In other words, it gives Ruth a chance to prove herself within the narrative. She faces adversity. She faces an incredibly difficult situation where she's starving, she's desperate, she has no status, she is Ruth the Moabite. But in the midst of those obstacles, she continues to demonstrate her faithfulness. And even when we think of Proverbs 31, right, the essence of a Proverbs 31 woman is a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. And that's what we see with Ruth. Even though she's a Moabitess, she's a woman who fears the Lord. And because of that, God's faithfulness is displayed to her. And so I think even that idea of the people in the town have seen how you've responded, that was necessary for her to be truly accepted. And Boaz commends her for it. I also think it's interesting, Brian, that Boaz here in his response, he tells her, do not be afraid. So you have these terms of endearment, my daughter, but then he says, do not be afraid. And I don't think we should miss this. Ruth had reason to be afraid.
Yeah, a lot could go wrong here, right?
Yeah. I mean, in so many ways, perhaps Boaz, you know, maybe he's a nice guy in the field, but maybe when you give him a chance, maybe he would take advantage of me, or maybe he would take advantage of me physically and then just leave me behind and not marry me. Or perhaps someone else might see me and it would ruin my reputation. And Boaz realizes she has put all of her hope in his response. And so he looks at her with compassion and reassures her, saying, do not be afraid. Don't be afraid. I will respond. And if this person does not take his right of redemption, then by the name of the Lord, he takes an oath, just as Ruth did in chapter 1. An oath by the name of the Lord, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. And then, Brian, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this as well, because I see here that Boaz is intentionally thinking about the legitimacy of this entire thing. He considers how the elders will perceive her. He considers that, hey, I have to go through the proper channels of checking with this other person, making sure that he doesn't want to redeem Ruth so that then I can do it and everything is above board. Because, of course, the alternative would be, well, let's say Boaz says, nope, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it without asking. I'm going to do it without consulting. Well, then this guy could come back in the 11th hour and say, no, I have the first right, at which point the plan would be thwarted as well. So every single part of this is intentional. We see Boaz thinking of Ruth. We see him caring for her, and we see him wanting to make sure that there is no question at all as to the legitimacy of their marriage. What are some things that you see here?
Yeah, I see an important point of Boaz's character that's already been hinted at, but being brought out here, that he is not willing to shortcut God's plan. And I think that's an important thing we need to not skip over. We live in a culture that values expediency and values results. And the Bible time and time again stresses that it's the means, not just the end, that require careful attention. We can't shortcut the plans of God. We can't just accomplish God's purposes through means alien to God's character. Boaz says, look, there's a legal hiccup. I can't just do this thing. Now, he's a man of influence. He maybe could force it through. But if one of the key points in the story is Ruth trying to find legitimacy in society as part of it, no longer as an outsider, but now an insider, that undercuts the goal if we just skip past, right? If we skip past the kind of awkwardness of I have to ask someone else first if they want to marry you, right? I'm reminded, and this is slightly off topic, but G.B. Caird has a quote that has always stuck with me about this idea, and I want to read it for us. And he's speaking of Jesus in the temptation in the wilderness. We'll talk about it, but there's an analog here. He says, a man of fervent and dedicated spirit, feeling himself called to liberate the oppressed and to establish the reign of justice and peace, would be open to three types of temptation: to allow the good to usurp the place of the best, to seek God's ends by means alien to God's character, and to force God's hand by taking shortcuts to success. And these are the three temptations that Jesus faces in the wilderness in Matthew chapter 4. I think those temptations apply throughout the Bible in a myriad of stories, and I think this is one of them. Couldn't Boaz be tempted to go, I do want to marry her. Here's a beautiful woman. It will bring legitimacy. It will help salvage the reputation of my family. Who cares about that kind of annoying little legal hurdle that there's someone else that has first right of refusal here? God certainly seems to be blessing this, so let's just take the shortcut. Why not? We see that he recognizes, no, I will follow God's plan wherever it leads. He even says, if that guy marries you, so be it. Right? There's no hint of like, I'm going to fight it. I'm going to contest it because our love, this would be the modern retelling of it, right? Because our love just can't be constrained by rules. He goes, no, I will follow the will of God. I will be faithful. If I have the opportunity, I will eagerly accept it. And if not, I will step aside. In either case, Ruth, you will now be part of this community. You will be an insider, right? If the other gentleman takes this right and marries her, great. She has still accomplished her purpose, and Boaz recognizes that. He's not willing to put his own needs in front of her needs or in front of the plan of God. And so I think that's significant. We've already seen, and we keep adding to it, Boaz, in a time of wickedness and self-centeredness, is an exceptional character, as is Ruth, which I think, Tim, is why we both keep coming back to the story as one of our favorites. These are real people, but people that seem to be following after God with whole hearts and stand outside of kind of their cultural milieu and standards as better people than we would expect. It's fantastic. Now, moving ahead, Tim, if it's all right, to verse 14, we get the kind of move to the next scene. So Boaz, in 13 rather, says, stay the night. Why does he say stay the night? I want to come back to that. In 14, we get the, she does. She lays down at his feet until morning and gets up when it's dark and says, and Boaz rather says, don't let it be known a woman came to the threshing floor. Now, why did he ask her to stay the night? The modern conservative answer is because it's dark and it's dangerous. We did talk about that. Threshing floors can be places of danger, right? They're outside the city. There are wild animals. There are robbers. Maybe not safe for her. And that's, I think, a very valid reading. Did something happen? And is that a problem if something happens when he asks her to stay the night? There is something odd, Tim, and we mentioned this before we started recording in verse 14. We have what's called a Ketiv Karei issue. Now, listeners, you might be going, what the heck is that? Well, Hebrew originally is written as a consonant-only language. There are no vowels, or at least not in the general sense that we mean them, vowels in the Hebrew alphabet. Instead, we have vowel pointings. Well, what happens is we have the Masoretes, a scribal family in the Middle Ages, come in and put in the vowel pointings on how to read it. But occasionally, the consonants don't match what they say you should read here. The consonants seem to indicate one word, but the vowels for a different word will be put in. This is what's called a Ketiv Karei issue, what is written and versus what is said. So you are always supposed to interpret based on what is said, the Karei. Tim, she lays down at his feet, plural. That seems to be very non-sexual. That's just a location, a locative, right? She just sleeps there. Mm-hmm. What if I told you, though, the consonants written there, it's feet, singular. Feet, singular? That's not grammatically correct in English. It's foot, which is a clear euphemism. Mm-hmm. That's what's actually written in the consonantal text. It is written kare with the vowel pointings for feet. What do you make of that? How do we handle this as kind of modern Christians looking back at the story?
Yeah, great question, Brian. The way I look at it is that rabbis for a very long time have been having exactly the same discussion that we are having now. What on earth happened at the threshing floor with Boaz and Ruth? So there's two different readings, right? There is the reading that's in the text. There's the corrected reading or the way that someone interpreted that reading. Is it singular? Is it plural? And even if it is singular, what does that mean? Does the fact that she lay at his feet mean that they somehow consummated their relationship at that point? To me, that seems highly unlikely because Boaz knows that her honor is incredibly important, especially in the potential proposal for marriage, whether it's him or whether it's the other kinsman redeemer. So if we were to read this as some kind of sexual encounter, then essentially what we would have to do is to say, well, there is this high character woman, this high character man. And in this moment, we would either have to bite the bullet and say, well, they did this, and yet it wasn't dishonoring to God, which to me, I think there's a problem there. I think that the intent is to say there was an opportunity, but she lay at his feet until morning, but got up while it was still dark. My reading of it is that nothing happened. It's a preservation of their honor so that later on, whenever she does conceive, there's no question as to the legitimacy of the child. But as we look at this, this is the debate, right? What happened? Mm-hmm. And again, I'll say it one more time. There is no doubt that this would have been scandalous. There's a reason that Boaz doesn't want Ruth to be discovered. And I think, frankly, for his own sake, he doesn't want it to be discovered that there was a woman there at night. So both of them have their reputation at stake. But in my mind, as we read this, I think it's carefully crafted to push us to the edge of what is acceptable, but I don't see this as definitively saying that something happened and we're supposed to read between the lines. What say you, Brian?
Yeah, it would be a lot easier without a Ketiv Karei issue here, right? If it's she laid down at his feet, yes, it can be a euphemism, but then that seems to be more locative, especially when we get to this point. Mm-hmm. If it's taken as what is written, she laid down next to his leg, singular, he's not an amputee, shall we say. And so then it becomes a little bit more awkward. Like you, Tim, I kind of go based on how we've been describing Boaz's character, it would seem to then be out of character for them to actually consummate a relationship here, since he himself has acknowledged that there might be someone else. If he had said, no matter who this person is, I'm dropping them, you know, I'm going to push them out, whatever. Then you could maybe go, okay, they are guaranteed to be married. We might, as modern readers, go, ooh, they kind of did that out of order, but maybe that's fine. I am hesitant to say an actual consummation of sex happened here, but I also want to say, look, we are dealing with real people in the real world, and even the best characters are still people at the end of the day. And so I think there's an opening here. You could read it either way. Like you, I tend to go, I think the text is intentionally trying to play with words to push us right to the edge, but not go over it, because it's trying to say this is something categorically different than Lot and his daughters, how Moabite women have acted in the past. Ruth is categorically right. different. Boaz is categorically different, and they are better. We do have a hint, by the way, that this was meant to be taken as scandalous. Look at Boaz's words, listeners, if you have your Bible open, in verse 14. Don't let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Your translation may say a woman, but it is the woman. Who is he talking to? It seems to be, if he's saying the woman, he's talking actually to his workers. There mm-hmm. is some awareness that some, right, that he had a visitor, whether or not anything happened. And so this is going to be a scandal, but this also then gives impetus to the fact that he is not going to just let this sit and brew. We're going to very quickly move to the final confrontation. Sounds aggressive. It's not going to be an aggressive thing, but we're going to move the ball down the road. We're going to talk to that other kinsman redeemer the very next day. And I think we see the hint of why that has to happen. It's because there is some awareness amongst his workers that Ruth was there. Now, just before the scene ends, Tim, and we are going a little bit long, but that's fine. We have one final little addition to the story.
Yeah.
Once again, Boaz gives Ruth food. Depending on, there's an interesting textual issue here again. If we read it just as is, he gives her something like 300 pounds of food, if it's a standard unit of measure, which every commentator is like, that's probably not unit of measure they're intending there. But Tim, he gives Ruth food to take back to Naomi. Why is this added in here at the end of the story?
Yeah, I love this. I love the kind of epilogue to this scene. As we think about Boaz says, do not return to Naomi empty-handed. He recognizes that this is not something that Ruth came up with on her own. He sends food back to his future mother-in-law again. He's a wise man, that Boaz. And he says, make sure that she knows I'm not just saying this in words, but I'm going to give, in a sense, the first fruits. I'm going to give the down payment. I'm going to give the seal of redemption, as it were, by sending you home. You know that I'm a man of my word, but I'm going to give you, we might call it like earnest money. I'm going to show you that I am taking care of you and that I am serious about this. And as we think about Naomi, remember what Naomi says. She says, I left full and I came back empty. But now Boaz, in this act of generosity and kindness, essentially is saying to Naomi, no, you will never be empty again. One way or the other, whether it's me, whether it's someone else, you are going to be taken care of. And I've got to tell you, Brian, I laugh when I read these last verses of chapter 3, because you know that Naomi is there. She is on pins and needles. What's happening? What's going on? Why is Ruth still there? Why has she not returned? And so she just says, what happened, my daughter? Tell me. And of course, Ruth does. She recounts all that happens. And she tells Naomi, Boaz told me not to return to you empty-handed. And Naomi says, okay, Boaz is not the kind of man who will rest until this matter is resolved. And so at this point, Ruth and Naomi have played all of their cards. Their future is no longer in their hands. But as we're going to see in chapter 4, God has moved to protect those who are most vulnerable, the widow, the foreigner, and he's going to use Boaz to bring about a level of redemption that Naomi never would have even thought possible. So it's a beautiful ending, but we before we get to the end, this is so important for us as people who've read this many times. We need to let the suspense build. We need to put ourselves in Naomi and Ruth's shoes. Boaz has said this, but now the question is, will he come through? Will he be a man of his word? And so chapter 3 ends with suspense, and so will we, as we think about where this story is going. Brian,
you'll have to come back next week to see where this all goes in chapter 4. Yes. Thank you for that, Dr. Tim. Listeners, we have two more episodes in the Book of Ruth, and then we'll finish that out. And we have a few epilogue episodes as well as we reflect on the value of Ruth, the significance of Ruth to the biblical storyline, and all those ideas. Thank you, Dr. Tim, for all of your insight today. Listeners, we hope this has been edifying for you. We hope it has built up your interest in studying the Word of God, seeing all the interesting questions that can be driven as we study deeper and deeper. We hope you come and join us next week. And until then, stay cool and stay open.